Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, so for all of that, all the politicking and debating and the near defaulting, what exactly has changed? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, August the 2nd. Good to have you with us. And I offer, as we get started, two statistical representations of the debt limit debate just mercifully brought to a close. First of all, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 265 points today, almost 2.2% for the blue chips. Also, the 10-year T-note, the yield on the benchmark Treasury, fell today down to 2.61%. Crazy low, but a big vote of market confidence. So one is left with this. After all that's happened, default, no default, whatever, where are we? For that, we've got our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on the line. Hey, Heidi.
Hey, Kai.
So we've got the deal. Everything's set and fine. But are we better off now than we were like 48 hours ago?
Well, the good news is we're better off than we were 4 months ago when we first started debating this. But the question is, how well off are we going to be starting now? The whole debt ceiling debate made us look dysfunctional. We all know that. But just because it's over doesn't mean we're going back to our regularly scheduled programming. We're a different country now. Everything that Congress has decided is that we are going to enter a period of belt tightening, right? Economists call it austerity. And this is the first time that we're really entering austerity in a really long time. So when you look at it from the point of view of Wall Street, of investors who buy Treasury bonds, who make decisions on whether to buy into the U.S., we're no longer that great big expanding power. We're now a power that is contracting. We have a lot of internal problems to take care of. And one of the things that people on Wall Street are really concerned about is entitlements. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those are obviously huge flashpoints for people, but investors want to see the cost for those come down before they really have confidence in us.
Well, let me back you up for a second, Heidi, and ask you about that bit about people buying into the United States. When they do that most of the time, what they're buying is Treasury bonds and bills. And we've been talking for weeks now about the possibility of a downgrade of our credit rating, about whether or not people are going to want to keep on buying our stuff. Has any of that changed?
Yeah, that's another, you know, meanwhile back at the ranch, right? Now that we have to refocus on where we actually stand, our credit rating may be safe, but we've made this huge public spectacle of ourselves in terms of our debt. And we have this huge debt, these huge revenues, and the math just doesn't work. And so that indicates something about where we are as a country and whether investors can trust us. I talked to Michael Mata at ING Global Bond Fund, and I asked him what he thinks and what Wall Street's saying about this.
You know, I think it actually does impact the country's ability to project power, which is another struggling giant. It was just like the European Union, in a sense, or the Japanese, or the British. The amount of power that the U.S. has is declining, right? And we can't issue more bonds to fight more wars, let's put it that way.
Basically, what that tells us is that investors are now thinking twice about what to do with their U.S. investments. They're diversifying a little bit. They're buying debt in other countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and they're buying gold, which we've seen happen for years now.
All right, back up for a second and put this in the very macro context of the recession that we thought was over a year and a half ago. The president, when he spoke today after the Senate vote, talked about the recession in present tense, like it's still going on. Do you believe that? And if you're not sure it's still going on, could we be looking at a double dip now?
It's really hard to tell people that there's not a recession. It looks like a recession, it walks like a recession, it talks like a recession, and it pays like a recession, which is to say, not at all. And so it's very difficult to tell people, no, this isn't a recession. Who are you going to believe, us or your own eyes? There's an economist, Kenneth Rogoff. He says that we're actually in the second great contraction. And it may worry you to know that the first great contraction was actually the Great Depression.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it takes into account
And it does take into account the fact that we have to cut our debt. And until then, we're going to have very low growth as an economy. In fact, some people think zero growth. But the good news is, as long as we don't tank, we're still winning.
Heidi Moore, our New York bureau chief, with the somber economic news of the day. Heidi, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Heidi mentioned our regularly scheduled economic programming. Before we got all caught up with ourselves, Europe was the long-running soap opera. And sure enough, now that we've put off our problems for at least a couple of months, the Eurozone debt crisis has moved once more into the breach. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard brings us up to date.
10 days ago, European leaders bailed out Greece for a second time and proudly unveiled a package of measures to stop the European debt crisis in its tracks. 10 days on, says economist Simon Tilford, the package is unravelling.
A very, very serious situation developing in the Eurozone. Contagion to Spain and Italy is gathering pace.
Investors dumped Spanish and Italian government bonds, driving interest rates so high the two governments will struggle to service their debt. Spain and Italy may need to be bailed out, just like Greece, Portugal and Ireland. But that could mean the end of the Eurozone.
If Spain and Italy find themselves in a similar position to Ireland, Greece or Portugal, then it's game over for the Euro, really.
Many believe Spain and Italy are too big to be bailed out. But Holger Schmieding of the German bank Berenberg says that, as with the US and its debt ceiling, Europe will find a way.
The euro is seen as the ultimate achievement of 60 years of European integration. And I do believe that the major countries will go to great lengths to keep that together.
He believes the European Central Bank, backed by the might of the German economy, may step in and buy up Spanish and Italian government bonds. But Tim Leunig of the London School of Economics has his doubts.
The question is, do Germans want to guarantee Greek, Italian and Spanish debt? I don't see any evidence of that.
Having settled their debt crisis, Americans may be tempted to feel a little smug. They shouldn't. If the euro falls apart, every corner of the global economy would feel the effects. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oh, cover your eyes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Pharmaceutical conglomerate Pfizer reported modest profit growth today. Sales of prescription medicines were down, but another part of the Pfizer empire picked up some of that slack. For the first time ever, Pfizer's sales of drugs for animals passed the $1 billion mark. A bad economy apparently has people cutting back on medical spending for themselves, but fortunately for Big Pharma, we're still shelling out for our pets. Sally Herships has that story.
The drug industry for animals is kind of like the golden retriever puppy of the pharmaceutical world.
The nice thing about the animal health business is they're pretty steady growers.
Damian Conover is a healthcare analyst at Morningstar. He says animal drug sales rise about 3 to 6% a year, and that dependability is welcome in a roller coaster industry where profits often depend on patented drugs for humans, like Lipitor, the Pfizer blockbuster that loses its patent this year.
In contrast, patents don't have as big a role in animal health. So when a specific product loses exclusivity, you know, the drop-off isn't as dramatic.
Companies like Merck, Bayer, and Novartis all sell drugs for animals. The industry is worth $20 billion a year worldwide. When you compare it to the drug market for us humans, animal meds may only be the tiniest piece of kibble, but still.
Just about everybody is making money on pets.
We spend almost as much medicating our pets as we do our beasts of burden, the pigs, chickens, and cows that feed the world. Eric Gordon teaches the business of health at the University of Michigan. He says medical advances give pet owners a lot more to spend on.
We will have them x-rayed. We will have them vaccinated. We will give pets cancer treatments.
A recent Morningstar report noted that pet ownership is rising, and in many households, pets are treated as surrogate children. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On the theory that we all want cleaner air, we can all take heart from the words of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu earlier this year. There is going to be, the secretary said, a massive shutdown of coal-fired power plants in this country over the next 8 years. Two things at work there, mainly new pollution regulations and a turn toward cleaner energy. And it means some of the country's oldest, dirtiest power plants aren't long for this world, which is great until it's your power plant. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner has the story.
More than three centuries have passed since the Salem witch trials, but this little city on Boston's North Shore is still capitalizing on that cursed chapter of American history.
To the good folk of Salem in 1692, the devil and witchcraft were realities. They could hear him in the howling of wolves, in the creaking of an old house on a winter's night.
Witch museums, souvenir broomsticks, psychics, they all keep Salem's kitschy tourism economy burning. But it's the town's aging coal-fired power plant that's really helped fuel the witch city's budget. For six decades, Michael Harrington's father was mayor when the Salem Harbor power plant was built in the early 50s. It took out his favorite baseball field. But Harrington says the soot-spewing utility gave plenty back in property taxes.
More than sufficient to pay the entire educational cost of Salem for probably the better part of the next generation.
The power plant is still the city's biggest taxpayer, by far. But the coal plant's current owner, Dominion, plans on shutting it down in 2 years. Over the next decade, dozens of aging coal plants just like it are slated to close around the country. The trend leaves host cities like Salem with cleaner air, but a hole in their budgets. Already, Salem Mayor Kim Driscoll is wondering where they're going to get the nearly $5 million a year Dominion pays in property taxes.
It's a huge hit to your commercial tax base, and it could have an impact on property taxes.
So if that money, if that $4.75 million were to go away tomorrow, you'd be in trouble.
Absolutely. We still have the same number of police calls, the same number of parks to keep clean and roads to plow, but we wouldn't have a big revenue source coming in.
Not to mention the kind of philanthropy big companies like Dominion do in small towns like Salem. State Rep. John Keenan can tick them off, starting with the $1 million Dominion donated to the schools just this year.
Whether it's the fireworks here in Salem, where they're a lead sponsor, the Salem Education Foundation auction, they're a lead sponsor, Boys and Girls Club, Salem Y, you name it.
All this from an ugly, dirty coal plant that, frankly, mars the picturesque Atlantic coastline around Salem Harbor. Even residents who live right near the plant seem to have a soft spot for it.
I always thought that they were a pretty good neighbor.
Former fisherman Jack Snow's attitude toward the coal plant is fairly common among residents here. They put up with it because it helped reduce their property taxes and created good-paying jobs. Snow says when he was a teenager in the 60s, the coal plant hired him and his buddies to shovel coal onto huge conveyor belts.
It was a dirty, nasty, dusty, noisy, just a horrible job, but it paid really well. And when you were, you know, like 15 or 16 years old, at that time, I mean, the average wage that the guys were making in factories was about $2 an hour. And they were throwing you 12 to sit there with a shovel.
Jane Bright leads a local health group that's been fighting the coal plant for years. From a small island near the plant, she looks out towards Marblehead, a wealthier community that will no doubt be glad to see the plant go.
This is one of something on the order of 300 coal plants in the country, so we have a long way to go as a nation, but yes, we'll be pleased to see this get out of our lungs and get out of our lives.
A lot of people in town hope the plant will be torn down to make way for a new waterfront development that will add to Salem's tourist economy. There's talk of wind turbines, a cruise ship terminal, new restaurants, shops, condos, maybe even conversion to a natural gas plant if Dominion can find a buyer. But Mayor Kim Driscoll says the coal plant won't be replaced overnight. That's why local politicians are lobbying for state funds to fill the gap until Salem can replace the taxes the plant now pays, if they can find a replacement in this economy.
Most of the plants or any similar type industrial properties that have been redeveloped have taken decades and have cost hundreds of millions of dollars. So we're very concerned that nothing happens on the site. That's the worst possible scenario.
And the kind of economic curse America's witch city wants to avoid. In Salem, Massachusetts, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up,
money was metaphorically allied to excrement. The money was filthy.
Paging Dr. Freud. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tumbled 265 points today, lost more than 2% of its value. The blue chips did, closed at 11,866. The NASDAQ dove 75 points, 2.75%, ended at 2669. The S&P 500 jettisoned 32 points, about 2.5% there, finished at 1254. Today's bad news came from the Commerce Department. Consumer spending fell in June for the first time in 2 years. That, along with some weak corporate profit reports, sent investors running for the exit. Shares of GE dimmed 4.2% today. Fellow Dow components Pfizer and United Technology also shed more than 4%. Shares of Metro PCS lost more than 35% of their value after the cell phone company's quarterly profit missed expectations. Meantime, food processor Archer Daniels Midland blamed soaring corn prices for the slump in its quarterly earnings. Shares wilted more than 6% today. Bond prices jumped, as I mentioned, up on top. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for June. The Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rates and the economy. This is one of 8 regularly scheduled meetings throughout the year. And he's an Emmy Award-winning actor known for many roles, including one as President Bartlett on The West Wing. Happy birthday, Martin Sheen. He'll be 71. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, now that that nasty debt ceiling business has been taken care of, Congress is about this close to its August recess. Lawmakers get a month off starting on Friday, and if they're like regular people, they'll probably spend part of it reading a good book or two. And that, as it happens, is where we come in. For our summer book series this year, we've asked people from different professional walks of life about writing and work, books that have shaped their careers or helped them figure out why they do what they do. Today, biomedical engineer Nina Tandon.
For my day job, I'm a tissue engineer. I work with cells in the lab and I try and direct their growth. Most of my research is centered on the heart, but I've also worked with skin and bone. I take a lot of pictures of cells at the microscope, pictures of what the cells are doing. And I've always been a photographer at heart, and I practice photography since college. I even used to exhibit quite a bit, but now my art is pretty much limited to the calendars I make for my brother. And my science often remains sequestered in the lab. And my brother, as opinionated as he is not exactly an audience. So when I saw Carl Schoonover's book, Portraits of the Mind, I was blown away. At first glance, it's a dazzling art book. Imagine a coffee table collection of captivating, colorful, abstract images. But then take a closer look and see something else. These stunning images are actually charting scientists' exploration of the brain throughout history. Shades of gray are revealed to be electrons transmitting through a single synapse, or what looks like a roaring fire is actually a time frequency diagram of brain rhythms. These images are so beautiful, they tickled my brain and then twisted it in knots, because not only are these images the product of the human ingenuity under exploration, but they're also the clues to unraveling its mysteries. I hope that airing these images out will allow a broader audience to feel a bit closer to the biology of the brain. After all, the brain is our internal narrator, our personality's executive producer, so to speak. But the book also encourages a deeper appreciation for the persistent, resourceful scientists who throughout the ages have attempted to illuminate the mysteries of the mind. They have created art via science.
Nina Tandon is an electrical and biomedical engineer at Columbia University's Laboratory for Stem Cells and Tissue Engineering. We've got some pictures from the book she was talking about on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook. There are probably a lot of people in this country who feel a good deal more broke than they did, say, early in 2008 for Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and the last 3 years of a stuck economy. And when you can't pay for stuff, be it your mortgage or ice cream for your kids, it's hard to admit that to yourself, let alone to other people. So today on our series, The Art of Money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, we're going to explore the idea of humiliation as it relates to the cash we have on hand or don't have on hand. And for that, we've turned to critic and poet Wayne Kestenbaum. His new book on the topic is a compact little volume. It's full of painful, cringeworthy revelations called, yes, of course, Humiliation. Wayne, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Take a minute and give me the difference between humiliation and shame.
I think shame is a private feeling. It may feel lacerating and terrible, but nobody necessarily sees it. So I would say that humiliation requires a scene. It usually requires some act of cruelty or some catalyst from the outside, a kind of oppressor or tyrant, let's say the boss who fires you. And it requires the spectators. It requires those who see you lose your job, the bill collectors who come knocking.
These have been, to turn into the economics of all this, it has been difficult for a lot of people. There's been anger and fear over losing jobs. Is humiliation a part of that experience as well that so many people have been going through?
Oh, absolutely. I think even fearing for the security of one's job is humiliating. The feeling of being watched and judged. Certainly losing a job leads to concrete suffering and hardship, but also to a sense of loss of status, self-esteem, a sense of how you appear in others' eyes, standing in the community. All the markers of identity and dignity are trashed in a way when you lose a job.
It comes down to, in the final analysis, this very complicated relationship we have with our professional selves, right? Our identities as a person in the workplace and our status and the loss thereof.
Mm-hmm. Everybody wants in life legibility and recognition. From infancy on, you want to be seen by the important other person, and you want to matter. As a grown-up, the way that we matter is that one big way that we matter is that we have enough money to live and that we have a professional identity. And when that vanishes, we're just left with our bodies and our histories, and that can feel like nothing.
Why is this relationship we have with money so difficult?
Well, you know, Freud said a lot of weird things, but he also said a lot of profound things. And one of the profound things he said is that money was metaphorically allied to excrement. The money was filthy. And so money is something that we are unconsciously ashamed of. Much as we treasure it, we're ashamed of it. Money, filthy lucre. Mm. So those connected to money or to the absence of money, paradoxically, are liable to scapegoating.
Let me turn that idea of money being dirty back on you for a second. You have a story at the very end of the book. You're about to go into a high-end restaurant. You see a guy begging for money. You give him a couple of dollars, whatever it is, and your hands touch in a very slight way. And you say, you admit actually to us, because I guess humiliation has to be witnessed, that you had to wash your hands afterwards.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say maybe so strongly that I had to wash my hands afterward, but
you wanted to,
I remember, I mean, and I'm a little compulsive, I remember the sequence of events very vividly, that here I was entering this fancy restaurant. I was wearing leather pants. I was with friends. We had taken a taxi there. It was an expensive restaurant, more expensive than I'm comfortable going to. Outside of this restaurant, there was a guy begging. We were all, in my little group, white. He was not. And you could say, well, then, if I consider, okay, I humiliated, this guy was humiliated that he had to beg. I felt, in a way, shamed by my economic privilege. But on the other hand, why bother making a story out of it? The answer to that might have to do with the secret alchemy of both humiliation and of writing, that we seek absolution or reparation by repeating, by narrating. And that also as a writer, well, specifically as a writer of a book on humiliation, how could I generalize about the humiliations of others if I didn't step into my own life and tell a few stories honestly.
The book is called Humiliation by social critic, poet, and author Wayne Kestenbaum. Wayne, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
To read a little bit of Humiliation, you can find the first chapter on our website. It's marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which, as it happens, is lifted from our friends over at Freakonomics. I'm sure they won't mind. Does what web browser you use say anything about how smart you are? Turns out, yes, it does. A study by Aptiquant Psychometric Consulting, and no, I'm not making that up, says people who use Microsoft's Internet Explorer browser score lower on IQ tests than users of every other browser out there. Smartest web surfers, by the way, Firefox. Details, if you can figure out how to get your browser to point over there, at Freakonomics.com. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow tumbled 265 points, more than 2%. The NASDAQ dove 75 points, 2.75%. I guess I've settled that dive-dove thing, huh? The S&P 500 jettisoned 32 points, about 2.5%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Beat, and that is where you ought to turn for the latest in business and economic news come tomorrow morning. Next time, back on The Big Show, takes a village, you know.
The people who live here are truly devoted to this town. It really wasn't that difficult to get those 12 families to come together.
Furniture and the economic future. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.